Hello and welcome to the BizNews Breakfast Briefing, our daily podcast wrap-up of the news, analysis and insights that you need to know. Today we start off with an expert roundup of the markets from Alec Hogg, followed by an interview that BizNews Michael Apple had with Outer Head Wayne Duvenage. He discusses Transport Minister Fikile Mbalula's recent announcement that a final determination will be made about the future of e-tolls in Gauteng in October's midterm budget policy statement. And then Alec brings us another in-depth interview, this time with renowned academic and fierce ANC critic R.W. Johnson on the predictions he made for the country at the dawn of our democracy and why he chose South Africa as his home over Oxford University. Please remember that these interviews are just brief extracts and that you can find the full pieces on biznews.com. And now it's over to Alec with the markets.
Thank you, Lucy. On to the markets. Good morning. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com. And as you can hear, some extended applause there. The All Share Index on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange up by 2% yesterday, 2.1% if you want to be picky. And that followed a nice move in other markets around the world. Of course, the United States was closed for the 4th of July holiday, so no budging there. But the futures markets for both the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ composite are up. So it does suggest that the firmer trend that we saw on the JSE and indeed around the world yesterday is likely to continue, well, certainly as far as the next few hours is concerned. One doesn't know in these turbulent markets nowadays. Bitcoin had a good day in the absence of major trade in the US, up by 6% to 20,206. So it's back above that important 20,000 level. The Jaltech basket, working a little bit behind, was down 1% at 315 rands and 21 cents. And the gold price, 1,811 dollars, unchanged, exactly unchanged from where it was last week. Onto the losers and winners on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. Was a good day for resources. That's what pulled the market higher. Sasol up 6.75%. You know that Sasol rises when the oil price rises, so it's easy enough to put those two together. Imperial had a good day as well, a heavy industrial company, up by nearly 6%. Harmony Gold, 5%. Anglo Platinum, 5%. Sappi, 4.5%. PPC bounced back, 4.5%. Polar World, 3%. Anglo Gold, 3%. So that gives you an inside view on what was happening on the top 40. Indeed, there were only two stocks on the top 40 that fell. Telkom down 2% and Aspen down 1%. So generally speaking, pretty good news as far as share prices are concerned yesterday. The rand virtually unchanged against the dollar, 16 rand and 32 cents, down 1 cent, and at 19 rand 77 cents, down 2 cents against the British pound. So what are we looking forward to today? Well, it's not quite quarterly season yet, but that's what we've got to keep our eyes open for. I had a fascinating discussion yesterday with Corian's David Bacher, and he explained how we really are on a bit of a knife edge now on the JSE and on international markets as well, because what happens in the United States impacts the rest of the world, and what is going on in the United States over the next few weeks will be quarterly results. These are when the American companies go back to their shareholders, as they do every 3 months, and tell them what has happened in their profitability over that period. Now, why this is so important is that Wall Street focuses its attention laser-like on expectations. And if companies don't reach the expectations that the street wants them to or believes they should, then share prices tumble. And it can be a question of a few percentage points miss that really is enough to turn the direction of a share's trade. As things stand right now, US equities are offering good value. But that's as it stands compared with the earnings that analysts were expecting ahead of this last little rumble that we've seen in the US economy, where higher interest rates and the projection thereof is making people nervous and that impacts on spending patterns, and that can impact on the economy and, in fact, push it into recession. So the next few weeks are going to tell us whether the earnings that the analysts on Wall Street are anticipating are actually justifiable through economic conditions. If that sounds like a little bit of a mouthful, apologies, but it just gives you some more insight into the way that things are so complicated on the markets at the moment. Well, we've got a full show coming up for you. I'll be back again tomorrow. Cheerio.
Next up, we have Wayne Duvenage on the future of e-tolls.
How many times we've heard the minister tell us that the e-toll matter has been decided on or will be decided on and announced shortly. This has been going on for several years now. And to hear it once again is extremely frustrating, because this matter has dragged on for far too long, and we know the answer. They know the answer. They have to undo this decision on the Gauteng freeway network and find the alternatives to the funding, which have been provided to them for many years now by IATA and other critics, and yet they just seem to cannot make this decision.
So in a nutshell, what Fikile Mbalula said is that Cabinet has now definitely made a decision and that it is going to be communicated in the midterm budget policy statement, right? Which is in October.
Yeah, that's correct. But that would indicate that they haven't made a decision other than the decision is to end the collection of e-tolls to fund the Gauteng Freeway Improvement Bonds. Because we heard very clearly from that statement and other indications that they wanted to finance these bonds through the another increase in the fuel levy. And it would seem that that horse has bolted. They cannot do that amidst these rising prices and the whole fuel levy mess that's actually happening right now, because they have reduced the fuel levy. Even though temporarily, it would seem now that they're going to have to switch to the option, which is what we've been indicating for some time, and that is this freeway upgrade needs to be funded through allocations from Treasury, and that any decision to increase the fuel levy any further is just not going to happen at this time.
I was looking back over Twitter, and I've been covering e-tolls since 2012, so over a decade. And the question at the time that your organization, under a different name, was raising was, if you simply add a couple of cents to the fuel levy, you'll be able to fund this. So that horse is bolted, you're saying?
Yeah. At that time, it was 10 cents to the fuel levy, and they would have been able to have settled those bonds by now. To come a decade later and make this suggestion, that amount is probably three times the price if they wanted to do it, 30 cents and more. However, you know, they have increased the fuel levy by over 2 rand. In fact, it's 2 rand 7 cents since 2012. So they've got the money as far as we are concerned. At that stage, the fuel levy was bringing in just over 1 rand, 1 rand 40 roughly cents per litre. It's now 3 rand 85. So they do have the funds. And by the way, Michael, they've already been allocating funds via Treasury allocations to SANRAL to offset these Gauteng Freeway Improvement Bonds to the tune of over 14 billion rand in the last 6 years. So they've been practicing that mechanism of finance for some time now. To now come and try and increase the fuel levy at this late stage is just unacceptable.
I was watching an interview I did with the CEO of the ETC back in 2018. And he was saying that they were banking on a compliance rate of 90%. He said at the time that they were getting a compliance rate of 30%. Was it ever that high even?
It reached 40% in June 2014. This was after 6 months of operating, but this was also after a very coercive campaign threatening a motorist that they will not be able to renew their licenses, that they'll get criminal records and they'll be summoned to pay and get blacklisted and so forth. So even under that, that coercive approach, they couldn't get past the 40% mark. These schemes do need 90% plus to survive. Many of them fail around the world as a result of the lack of compliance and buy-in by civil society, which this scheme had the hallmarks of right from the outset. So, yeah, it was always doomed to fail, but for some reason, government just really couldn't see what we could see, what our research was showing. And here we sit today, languishing at about 15% compliance, mainly government departments and a few fleet industry organizations who just continue to keep the scheme on life support, really.
We all know somebody who pays ETOLs. What's your message to those people?
Well, your money is best in your bank account than in SANRALs or ETCs. The scheme has failed. They have continuously pushed out the renewal process on the tenders. It is an absolute mess. That SANRAL themselves have acknowledged that they cannot continue with e-tolling anywhere else in the country, that this scheme is dead and nobody is being summoned. No one is being blacklisted. There is no negative consequences if you stop paying today. And we urge anybody who's still paying, in fact, most government departments aren't even paying. So there is no threat to you and your organization. And the quickest way to end this and help government make their decision is when the
And now for a fascinating excerpt of Alex's interview with R.W. Johnson.
Well, it's a long and distinguished career that you had at Magdalen College at Oxford, where you taught many leaders within the British political establishment, but you decided around about the time of democracy in South Africa to actually come back to this country. Now, given that you hadn't been here for that long initially, what was it that brought you back here to South Africa?
Well, after I left in 64, I didn't come back for 14 years. It just wasn't safe. But I was invited out to give some lectures in 78, and I did and enjoyed that experience a great deal. And of course, things had moved on in the country, and it was post-Soweto riots, and the police had a lot more real things on their hands. Instead of worrying about student radicals breaking house arrest orders, they were really dealing with, lots of trouble in the townships. So they were less interested in me. But after that, I used to come out about every 2 years, usually to teach at the University of Natal during the Oxford long vacation, because I had a good friend at Natal who was the professor, and he kept on inviting me. And that meant that through the 80s, I was able to keep in touch with what was going on, because I was coming out on this sort of two-yearly basis for about 6 or 8 weeks of time. And that was great, because I could link up with old friends and I could see what was going on. And it was a very stimulating period. A lot of things were changing quite fast. So by the 90s, I had decided that I would probably move back here, and then I was offered the job of directorship of the Helen Suzman Foundation, which I happily accepted, and that was in 95, and I came out then. But by then, I had been out here a great deal, and I'd been out doing a big book on the first democratic election with Laurie Schlemmer, and I'd been out then for 18 months, 2 years. So really, I'd spent a lot of time in South Africa in the 80s and early 90s before I came back in 91. And I mean, I was simply enchanted by, in a sense, having been an anti-apartheid activist and known lots of people in the ANC and all that sort of thing, to see it all through to 94 was to see the end of something which had been a major theme in my life and which I was delighted to see end. And I suppose to some extent I shared the euphoria about the changes, but I was always extremely concerned about the ANC, because having spent time in London with exiles and so on, I had no illusions at all that there were a lot of very authoritarian and often racist people in the ANC. And I knew that they would be a very, very, how can I put it? Well, completely ignorant and inexperienced set of hands at the wheel would be the nicest way to put it. And many of them I wouldn't personally trust. The idea, which was then current, that they had the moral high ground, seemed, if you knew them up close, you knew that was no more true of them than of any other large political movement, that there were all sorts of people there, who, some of them absolute rogues, and many of them very authoritarian, very ideological. And they were the last people that you could imagine really doing a good pragmatic job of running a country. And in a sense, I don't think they were really interested in it either. I mean, they were very ignorant about contemporary South Africa. Many of them had left long time ago. And as it were, they knew their way around the London Underground better than they did any city in Joburg, in South Africa, rather. So obviously they got over that. But so I was never very optimistic about the likely outcome. And my training as a political scientist meant that I knew quite a lot about similar sorts of experiences in other countries, and I'd studied elsewhere in Africa, especially in West Africa. And that too caused me to be fairly dubious about the euphoria of that time. And indeed, I remember there was a conference in Durban in the early 90s, where I found myself sitting next to Thabo Mbeki at a discussion group, which was all about investment in South Africa. And there were a whole lot of reverends. At that period, there were lots of sort of political priests around. And they wanted to make a big thing out of that anyone who was going to invest in South Africa would have to qualify through all sorts of moral and ethical tests before they would be allowed to invest. And I lost patience with this and said, look, you know, all over the world, people are trying to get people to invest in their countries, and they do not make them do moral high jumping before they're allowed to do so. And in fact, they're just delighted to get their money, and we cannot possibly, this is ridiculous. And I said, look, why don't we talk about real things? And the sort of real things that concern me is that, having studied independent Africa quite a lot, two things happened in most African states fairly soon after independence. One is that, having been self-sufficient in food, because the colonial administrations were not interested in importing food, they rapidly became big food importers and have remained so, and have failed agriculturally to feed their population. And the second thing was that, even though they all started with working power systems, within a very short time, they were all blacked out and had power cuts. Now, if we are talking realistically, then the two things that concern me are these. I want to, you know, we must be sure that South Africa can continue to feed itself, and that we're going to have reliable electric power. At which point, Mbeki got up and walked out. And everyone then turned on me and said, you've insulted him and you've upset him because of talking like that. It's a sort of suggesting that Africans aren't capable or something. I said nothing about that at all. I just said, look, this is the historic record, and we don't want that to happen here. So, you know, let's talk about real things. But I'll never forget it, because I'm sure I was the first person to raise that. And of course, not many years later, well, you know what happened. I mean, Mbeki was in charge when the key decisions were taken, which ended up with power cuts.
It's extraordinary that no one listened. Did it frustrate you?
That no one listened? Oh, no. That period, I was to raise issues like that was to be a reactionary and conservative and all these things, which I found very strange, because in Britain, while I was there for, you know, decades, I'd always voted Labour. I'd never been a Conservative. And indeed, I used to advise Neil Kinnock at one point when he was Labour leader. And I also advised some Labour cabinet ministers. And the... you know, it wasn't meant in terms of trying to suggest anything other than, you know, I would like it all to work. That's all. And I knew enough to know that these were real issues. But the South Africans, white and black at that period, were absolutely full of nonsense and unrealism. And they were very ignorant about what had happened elsewhere in the world and had no comparative sense about their own situation, if you know what I mean. And that's still a great weakness, that people don't even know their own history here very well, let alone that of other countries. And it means that the naivety is a huge thing in South Africa, and people simply aren't sufficiently well educated a lot of the time to make the sort of judgments which they need to. And it's a real problem, but certainly no one was willing to listen to anything like that. And I was repeatedly told that I was, you know, out of court for having such feelings or worries.
Has the penny dropped now at last with concerns about food security on the one hand, and then obvious, I don't think there's any South African who isn't aware of the other issue that you raised about power and electricity, given the level
two,
six.
I mean, those were just two issues that I brought up then. Obviously, there are many, many other points to worry about. But, I mean, one could, when Mike Sutcliffe was drawing up all the boundaries for the local government things, I mean, that was a disaster in the making. You could see that this wasn't going to work, and he was creating non-viable municipalities and so on. And then, of course, we got the cadres taking over, and we know what happened. But that was highly predictable, and we made all sorts of absolutely predictable mistakes, you know, which anyone who had any sense about how things had worked elsewhere in the world over time, and who had any sort of political science historical background, could not but be appalled by that we were walking into traps which really we should have been able to avoid, but they weren't. No one wanted to listen. And, you know, everyone was jolly naive, and it was extraordinary, really. But then, of course, everyone turned around and said they were very disillusioned and said, no, you were right. And so forth, you see. And they expected me to be full of disillusion too. And I wasn't, because, as I say, it's what I'd expected. I'd assumed all of these things were going that way for a long time then. I couldn't say that I'd had full of illusions which had been shattered. It just wasn't true. So I wasn't as upset and angry as they were, because they were sort of surprised and I wasn't. So I then found myself sort of less doom-laden than many, you know. And I mean, I suppose the point is I'm still here when lots of them have vanished, you know. Including, I may say, many people I know, I mean, some of them good friends, but who were passionately ANC supporters until the penny dropped, and then very quickly they were living in another country. And there never seemed to be a moment when they turned around and said, oh dear, I've made a big mistake. They never went through that. They sort of carried on believing a whole lot of nonsense until they got on the plane to leave, sort of thing. It was strange.
A lot of people who read your work, How Long Will South Africa Survive?, the articles that are often published in Rapport and on Politics Web, use it to almost confirm their own sense of desperation and unhappiness. Is that what you're trying to leave them with, or was there something bigger?
No, I'm not trying to spread any particular message to anybody. And it's often quite distressing to me when I write for, say, Politics Web or whatever, that I then get a whole lot of people writing in agreeing with me, or largely so, and then coming out with what I would call primary racism and saying all sorts of appalling things about black people, which I think are shocking and which I do not share. Because it does seem to me that although the period of the early middle 90s was full of very misplaced euphoria, that the really great gains of that period were that we all began to know one another as fellow South Africans and to mix with people of all races in a way that we hadn't really been able to before, and to try to get rid of racial prejudices and so forth. And that was a huge gain. And that's something we should preserve, you know. That was the good part of that period that we really all want to keep. And so I'm certainly not pleased when I find that people are taking anything I write as confirmation of their prejudices.
And that's all from us at BizNews today. Thank you for joining us. And please do remember to like, subscribe, and follow if you enjoyed this episode.